Chapter 12. Harder, better, faster, stronger. Record-breaking sports fabrics. Are we human? It's changed the sport completely. Now it's not swimming. Michael Phelps, 2009. The crowd crammed into the tiered seats around the pool knew that something was up. An expanse of baby blue sky presided over the Foro Italico, a grandiose 1930s Roman sports complex built in Mussolini's honour. It was the third day of the 2009 FINA World Championships, and yet 14 new world records had already been set, one by a shade under 2 whole seconds faster than its predecessor. The final race of the day was the men's 200-metre freestyle, and the competitors included Michael Phelps, the incumbent world record holder, and hero of the 2008 Beijing Olympics. 8 swimmers strode out in single file, sunlight gleaming on the smooth surfaces of their caps and besuited legs. The buzz of the crowd increased in pitch, the sound of a freshly poked hive. Phelps was in lane 3. His biggest rival, the German Paul Biedermann, was in the next lane along. The two studiously ignored each other, looking down the barrels of their own lanes. Phelps, USA, emblazoned in red on the back of his navy warm-up jacket, listened to music through an imposing pair of black designer headphones. On paper, he had nothing to worry about. The American, at 6'4", had a full inch on his German competitor and a more impressive track record. Just a year before, Biedermann had been out of the top 20 swimmers. At Beijing, he had come a distant 5th in the same event, with a time of 1:46 to Phelps's world record-setting 1:42.96. But a good deal had happened in the 11 months since. Phelps had, for a start, taken several months off after winning 8 golds at Beijing, a haul that made him, in the eyes of many, the most successful Olympian of all time. And then there was the vexed question of the suits. 4 days previously, competitive swimming's governing body, FINA, had decreed that new polyurethane-based swimsuits, such as the Jacket 01 and the Arena X Glide, were to be outlawed. Future competitors would race in textile swimsuits that would only reach from navel to knee in the case of men, and from shoulder to knee for women. What FINA hadn't decided was a definition for textile, nor a definite date from which the new regulations would come into force. For the moment, competitions were dominated by athletes wearing the polyurethane suits. 13 of the 14 records set in the Foro Italico pool so far had been claimed by swimmers wearing them. Biedermann would be racing in an X-Glide. At the end of the pool, the two athletes carefully wiped their starting blocks with towels to dry them, readjusted their caps over their ears, and jiggled their arms by their sides, first one and then the other. Biedermann slipped his thumbs under the sides of his suit, where it cut into the flesh of his shoulders and pectorals. They mounted their blocks, 1 foot in front of the other, bent double at the waist. "On your marks," a tinny female voice, and then a squeaky buzz and a splash as the black-clad swimmers dove forward into the water almost as one. Almost. Biedermann's start wasn't good, a fraction too hunched and deep and slow. It didn't matter. By the first turn he had closed on Phelps, all head and windmilling arms and wake, and then he was pulling ahead, the other competitors further back, but Phelps still shoveling the water towards his body furiously with each stroke, holding on, both swimmers below world record pace. By the blistering 4th lap, and with just 20 metres to go, Biedermann was a full body length ahead. He won the race in 1:42. Phelps was visibly furious. "Are We Human?" by The Killers belted out over the loudspeaker. Biedermann raised an index finger in the air, breathing hard, pink with effort and triumph. He was number 1. Almost before he was out of the pool, however, his whim was called into question. "I'm done with this," Bob Bowman, Phelps's trainer, told reporters. "The sport is in a shambles right now, and they better do something, or they're going to lose their guy who fills these seats." A threat with bite. The sport was still prickly from years of doping East German athletes in the 1970s and 1980s, but many were upset enough to raise even this ogre of sporting shame. Eric Chanteau, an American swimmer, compared the suits to the use of steroids in baseball. Bowman took a less direct, more barbed swipe. It took Michael from 2003 to 2008 to go from 146 to 142.96, he said. "This guy's done it in 11 months. That's an amazing training program. I would love to know how that works." Biedermann, at first ecstatic in victory. "I was there when Phelps won his 8th gold medal, and now I'm actually faster than him," wilted. "I hope there will be a time again when I can beat Michael Phelps without the suit. And I hope it will be the next year or really soon. But I also think it's not about the suit. It's not my problem. It's not the problem of Arena, my sponsor. It's the problem of FINA." Floaters. "I don't want to be just a pretty fish." Annette Kellerman, inventor of the one-piece bathing suit, who was arrested for public indecency when she wore it in public in 1907. The origin of this ruckus can be traced all the way back to the introduction of full body suits in 2000, but it really gathered pace almost a decade later. In February 2008, just a few months before the Olympic Games in Beijing, Speedo introduced their latest swimsuit technology, the LZR Racer. Eric Wilson of the New York Times was underwhelmed. "Some people," he wrote, "do get really excited about the slightest changes to the get-ups that swimmers wear at the Olympics." He didn't think it looked all that different to the brand's previous design, and when Speedo's media reps said the suits made swimmers look like gladiators or comic book heroes, he turned derisive. "As far as superheroes go, these would perhaps be best suited for Captain SeaWorld, the Avenger of Flipper." However, the LZR Racer was a big step forward. Speedo had partnered with NASA to find the materials that best reduced drag. Drag accounted for around 25% of the total force slowing swimmers down as they passed through the water. Less drag, faster swimmers. The fabric chosen was a lightweight, water-repellent, and very smooth blend of polyamide and elastane, although it felt odd against the skin, more like paper than cloth. There were far fewer pieces of it than in the previous model, 3 down from 30. The LZR Racer also showcased a new way of joining the pieces together. Traditionally, overlapping fabric is sewn together to create a seam, but this results in slightly bulging lines, which act like tiny breaks, infinitesimally slowing the wearer down. What the alternative Speedo hit upon was to weld the edges of the pieces of fabric together using the heat generated by ultrasonic waves. This reduced the profile of the seam, which in turn resulted in 8% less drag. The suits were to be worn as tight as a corset. Getting into the shoulder-to-ankle design required a zip, also low-profile and ultrasonically welded, and featured panels of polyurethane placed at specific points across the body, further helping to streamline it. The brand had previously used a Teflon coating instead. The results spoke for themselves. 2 months after it was introduced, swimmers wearing the LZR Racer had broken 22 world records, all but one of those set during that time. Another 26 had fallen by August. At the 2008 Olympics themselves, it was everywhere. When Jason Lazak, in a peerless final lap in the 4x100-metre freestyle relay, touched the wall wearing a special star-spangled version, he not only won the race, but obliterated the previous world record. 3:08.24 down from 3:12.23, a difference of 4 long seconds. A later Phelps gold at Beijing was earned by just 1/100th of a second. This was the third world record set that morning alone, and the seventh in 3 days of competing. Later that day, when an eighth record fell, the number of new records matched the total set during the entire 2004 Games in Athens. In the end, according to some counts, 97% of the golds won in the pool at Beijing were taken by swimmers wearing LZR technology. Many swimmers, especially those sponsored by Speedo, were effusive in their praise. Rebecca Adlington, who won 2 gold medals in 2008, absolutely loved the LZR, the shape of it, the full leg, the fit. Dara Torres, who had been modelling it at the launch, said that it helped her move through the water like a knife through butter. She also leapt to the suit's defence when a reporter denigrated the grey-on-black look. "You think it looks dull?" she asked. "We're there to swim fast. We're not there for a fashion show." But as the records fell, so the hackles of those worried about the integrity of the sport began to rise. One coach called the LZR suits technological doping, another drugs on a hanger. The latter spoke to the New York Times on condition of anonymity, because one of their own swimmers was sponsored by Speedo. But the problem was never quite as simple as how much faster the suits could make athletes swim. There was a strong belief that it was the best swimmer that should win, not the swimmer with the best technological advantage. Access to the LZR was uneven, which created unfairness in training for races as well as in the pool on the day. They only went on sale in May 2008, just a couple of precious months before the start of the Olympics. They were also expensive. Each one retailed for $550 and could only be worn a few times before they began to sag or seams split. Another issue was sponsorship. Athletes with deals with other brands could either forego the advantage of the LZR or risk endangering their lucrative sponsorship deals. Speedo athletes had none of these worries. There were howls of protest when a new generation of suits made entirely from polyurethane came onto the market. The Jacket 01, Arena X-Glide and Adidas Hydrofoil were, in one way, a logical evolution from the LZR racer. While the latter had only had polyurethane panels, the new suits were entirely covered with it. They compressed muscle more effectively, tautened the surface of the skin and, crucially for many in the industry, added buoyancy by trapping air between the water-repellent fabric of the suit and the skin. The bonded seam technology was also widely adopted. Traditionalists dubbed the new suits floaters because of the way they helped the bodies of the athletes ride higher in the water, which in turn helped them go faster. The fuller body coverage of the tech suits meant a greater surface area could be smoothed and tautened. Uncovered, even muscular flesh jounces, dimples and rolls around dramatically in the water when a swimmer is exerting themselves. All this wobbling creates extra drag, but the tech suits compress the skin, drastically reducing movement. For this reason, the fabrics used were usually weaves rather than knits. Suits had to be exceptionally tight-fitting. A journalist who squeezed herself into one described the experience as being akin to a lobster trying to molt backward. Athletes might spend 20 or 30 minutes donning a suit, welded seams straining in an unseemly manner. Because polyurethane is relatively fragile, the struggle risked the suit tearing or splitting. The reward for all this effort was speed. Swimmers, like seals, understand that sleeker is better. The suit's compression, coupled with strategically placed seams, helped keep legs higher and the core engaged and active, even as the swimmer began to tire, holding them nearer the optimum racing position. It's the difference, according to Steve Furness, a former Olympic medalist and the co-founder of the swimwear brand Tyre, between a barge and a racing boat. Another thing that riled swimmers and swim lovers was the belief that the technology rewarded some more than others, and those getting the most benefit were the wrong people. While some athletes' performance was little affected, others, like Biedermann, went from being 15th or 20th to top five during the tech suit era. There were some people, Rebecca Adlington says, who did really well in polyurethane and then were never heard from again. According to Joseph Santry, a former head of research at Speedo's Aqualab, such athletes were likely the ones with softer, pliable bodies with more adipose tissue, which the suit could squidge to get them into a more torpedo-like shape. In other words, the more honed and muscular you were, the less impact you were likely to get from a polyurethane suit. Although FINA had quietly gone to and fro on the issue of regulating the suits, the assault of new records set in 2009 proved too much. Phelps's loss to Biedermann turned what had largely been a series of internal debates into international news. The suits, Phelps told the press, had changed the sport completely. Now it's not swimming. The headlines are always who's wearing what suit. Suits had eclipsed swimmers. Less than 6 months later, FINA's stricter rules came into force and the tech suit era was over. Sports coverage. Nude. Clothed only in sunshine and beauty. Oscar Wilde, describing ancient Greek Olympians, circa 1891. Taking sport seriously isn't confined to the modern era. For Pausanias, a traveller and geographer who lived during the 2nd century AD, Olympia was the spiritual heart of his homeland. Many are the sights to be seen in Greece, he wrote, and many the wonders to be heard. But on nothing does heaven bestow more care than on the Olympic Games. Held in honour of the god Zeus, the ancient Olympic Games were a sporting phenomenon. For nearly 400 years from around 776 BC, tens of thousands of people would travel across the country every 4 years to witness them. So important were they, wars were suspended just before and during the festivities so that athletes and spectators could reach Olympia in safety. Once there, they would be treated to events including running and chariot races, wrestling matches, and javelin throwing. Victors were crowned with laurel wreaths. Apart from the reverence with which they were undertaken, the games had another surprising attribute. The competitors were all naked. These games were part of a larger Greek culture of nude athleticism. The very word, gymnos, the etymological root of gymnastics and gymnasium, means naked. Idealized male bodies can be seen in much of the art from the period. Broad of shoulder and trim of waist, they cavort around vases and in friezes, taut and engaged in movements so energetic that abdominal and arm muscles bulge. Then, as now, broader cultural anxieties about citizenship, ethics, sexuality and gender seeped into discussion surrounding athletics and sport. Whatever its purpose, it was a key part of Greek culture by the first half of the 6th century BC. Freeborn men would train diligently, eat correctly, libate their skin with vast quantities of olive oil, and receive regular massages to achieve muscle-bound perfection. A full-body tan, achievable only through regular nude training, was considered highly desirable. There were even special words for a bronzed backside, melampigos, and a white one, leukopigos. Tellingly, the latter was also used to denote cowardice and unmanliness. The best and proudest would then compete against their peers in public stadiums, all in the nude. In Sparta, where this found its fullest expression, physical activity was mandatory for young people. Unmarried women, as well as men and boys up to the age of 30, were kept busy with training, games and drills, which involved everything from choral dance to warlike games. Partaking in such events, and doing so with courage and vigour, had a moral component. Xenophon, for example, a Grecian historian in the 4th century BC, wrote that those who keep in training develop good skin, firm flesh, and good health from their food, whereas the lazy look bloated, ugly, and weak. Those who revealed cowardice were shunned socially. Despite this fulsome participation, Greeks were conscious that foreigners regarded exercising in the nude as immoral, and they themselves fretted about the sexual degeneracy it might engender. Both Plato and Thucydides pointedly mention the loincloths worn by foreign athletes, but even in Greece, nude physical activity was strictly reserved for certain members of the citizenry, and was only acceptable in certain contexts, the gymnasium and the stadium. All competitors had to be free-born, and although unmarried women could watch sporting events, at other times they were kept well away from the athletics and from the nudity. Even in Sparta, where girls did compete, possibly in the nude, more likely in short tunics or even shorts, this came to an abrupt halt when they married. Despite the qualms the ancient Greeks had about it, exercising in the nude, or as close to it as possible, does make practical sense. One popular story then was that nudity became acceptable during running races because a competitor had once been tripped up during an event by their own loosening loincloth. While this is likely apocryphal, it's certainly true that clothes tend to hamper movement and, in combat or team events, give opponents a means of gaining purchase or leverage. Even the thinnest layers will hinder the evaporation of sweat, a crucial physiological mechanism for cooling the body during exertion. Balancing the demands of morality and good taste with practicality has remained sensitive and, on occasion, fraught. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when the Olympics were revived, the scale was very much weighted towards morality. Rules in 1908 stipulated that every competitor must wear full clothing from the shoulder to the knee, i.e. sleeved jersey to the elbows and loose drawers with slips. Any competitor will be excluded from taking part in the race unless properly attired. During the 1912 Olympics, male athletes wore cotton t-shirts and knee-length button-fly shorts. In terms of coverage, however, very little has changed for many sports between then and now. For women, it was a very different matter. They were excluded entirely from the 1896 event, and when they were permitted to take part, had to do so wearing an extraordinary amount of clothing. Charlotte Cooper, the British gold medalist in both the tennis singles and mixed doubles at the Paris Olympics in 1900, played in a tight-fitting, ankle-length skirt, a blouse buttoned up to her neck and down to her wrists, a corset, and heeled shoes. A good many of the surviving photographs depicting female athletes taking part in the 1912 Stockholm Olympics focus on the victorious British freestyle swimmers, who were made to pose again and again in their clinging fabric suits that stretched to mid-thigh. In most images, they appear with another woman, possibly a trainer, who stands just behind them like a chaperone, wearing a long pinstripe dress, a demure lace collar, and a scowl directed right down the lens. This intense focus on modesty meant that technology for the garment women needed the most, a properly supportive brassiere, came much later on. On the face of it, the need for a sports bra couldn't be more obvious. When you bounce, your breasts do too, and it can be painful. It gets worse when you run. They jag up, down and around in a rough and, particularly for women with larger breasts, faintly tortuous figure of eight. Before 1977, women had their own intimate ways of dealing with the problem. Some hacked regular bras with duct tape, others layered one bra atop another. But 40 years ago, as the idea of jogging went mainstream, three women at the University of Vermont hit upon a more tailor-made solution, a pair of jock straps sewn together. From this prototype, the jock bra, swiftly renamed the Jog Bra for commercial reasons, was born. Resistance to sports bras, to women exercising, to breasts drawing any attention to themselves in public whatsoever, endured. In 1984, when Joan Benoit won the first women's marathon in Olympic history, her jersey slipped to reveal a simple white bra strap. It was an image captured by the press that scandalized many. 15 years later, another bra made it into the public consciousness, this time more deliberately. At the denouement of the FIFA World Cup soccer final between China and America, Brandi Chastain scored the winning penalty and celebrated in the traditional manner. Jersey whipped off, she fell to her knees with both fists raised to the sky. Although she later downplayed the moment in interviews, momentary insanity, she said, the sight of her and her black nylon sports bra made the cover of Newsweek and Sports Illustrated. Over the following decades, as social mores and attitudes toward the body have evolved, the clothes worn during sports have too. Clothes have certainly become more form-fitting, but concerns around modesty and exploitation mean there has been a continual renegotiation over what should and should not be exposed to the public gaze. The most notorious example is beach volleyball. While men played in shorts and tank tops, the official Olympic uniform for women from 1996 until 2012 was a bikini with a maximum side width of 6 centimetres. The reason for such a dictum was obvious to all involved and had nothing to do with sporting prowess. The people who own the sport, one volleyball player told the Sunday Times in 2008, want it to be sexy. The rules have since been changed, giving individuals more choice to cover up. Choice, cultural considerations, and the growing heft of the Islamic market, projected to be worth $5 trillion by 2020, also lay behind Nike's recent decision to launch a hijab made from a light, stretchy, and breathable synthetic blend. While it wasn't the first on the market, it has received rave reviews. One woman, who put it and many others through their paces during football, running and weightlifting sessions, wrote that she would have given a kidney to have a hijab like this when I was at school. For male athletes too, there have been subtle but discernible battles over the use and display of their bodies. When in 2016, ESPN magazine's annual body issue, which contains photos of sports stars in the nude, featured Vince Wilfork, a 325-pound American football player, as their cover star, it was considered daring and controversial. As Wilfork pointed out in a short behind-the-scenes film that accompanied the photo shoot, male athletes are still expected to conform to a body type similar to that seen on Grecian vases, and those that do are likely to get better sponsorship opportunities. This expectation, as well as the increasing commercialization of sport, has led to ever more fitted clothing. In basketball, for example, a sport in which shorts and jersey have traditionally been baggy, the latest generation, created by Nike, are much tighter. This sportier, less streetwear aesthetic is now common to many team sports, allowing brand names to be ever more clearly associated with the health and vitality of fit players. Given that close-fitting clothes would tend to restrict both the movement of the body and the evaporation of sweat, such clothing has only really been practical for physical activity since the development of sweat-wicking fabrics. Technology, according to sports writer Leonard Coppett, has changed the way virtually every game is played. And yet in most cases, the effects are almost invisible to spectators. He wrote these words in 1978. Still, it should come as no surprise that the tech suit controversy in 2008 and 2009 was not the first time such a brouhaha about clothing and equipment has engulfed a sport. It wasn't even the first time it had happened to competitive swimming. Alexander McRae, a Scotsman who had emigrated to Australia in 1910, launched the first non-woolen swimsuit, and with it the Speedo brand, in 1928. Today, wool seems an unfathomable material in which to swim. Heavy, itchy, highly absorbent, and liable to snag and flap around the body with every stroke. But far from being welcomed with open arms, McRae's racerback suit, made from silk, was so form-fitting and revealing, as the name suggests, it left a great titillating expanse of arm, shoulder, and back completely bare, that it was banned from some public beaches. Nevertheless, it soon gained ground with competitive swimmers. A Swede, Arne Borg, wore one while winning an Olympic gold and setting a new 1500-meter record in Amsterdam in 1928. 4 years later, Claire Dennis, a 16-year-old prodigy from Australia, broke another Olympic record wearing a racer back in Los Angeles, despite nearly being disqualified in the heats for exposing too much shoulder blade. Apart from an unfortunate incident at the 1972 Olympics, when the women's team from East Germany competed in cotton skin suits that became transparent when wet, the next big thing arrived in 1973. The 1970s, indeed, proved to be a decade rich in sporting equipment innovations. The World Aquatics Championships at Belgrade saw the introduction of stretchy spandex suits, worn once again by the daring East German women's team. They won 10 out of the 14 available medals and set 7 world records. The suits became known as Belgrads and were soon adopted the world over. Speedo were less progressive at this point. "These suits are gross," Bill Lee, the firm's North American manager, told Sports Illustrated. "You can see everything." In 2000, however, they once again made a splash, announcing a new bodysuit made from a material that, they claimed, mimicked the ability of denticle-covered shark skin to help ease the passage of an object through the water. It seemed to do the trick. At the Sydney Olympics, around 80% of the medal-winning swimmers were wearing the shark-inspired kit. Years later, however, Harvard scientists discovered that the much-lauded fast skin system wouldn't have reduced drag at all. Denticles, small tooth-like bumps on shark skin, do help sharks reduce drag and increase thrust, but those on the Speedo suits were both too widely spaced and too rigid to be of any use to athletes. The tug and pull between sporting purity and technological progress has had noteworthy lurches in many sports. Waves of new equipment and clothing have helped ensure a steady stream of fastest, firsts, and attention-grabbing world records. But they have also led to complaints, discomfort, and angst, such as that experienced by Leonard Coppett in 1978. "The whole idea of a game," he wrote, "is to establish rules that create constant conditions, so that painstakingly acquired skills can be brought to bear in a known framework. If memorable wins, fast serves, and great distances are only achieved with the introduction of new equipment, are they truly valid? Are potentially magnificent athletes going unrecognized because kit has become a barrier to entry? At what point does enhancement obscure true achievement?" In hindsight, many technological upgrades seem so natural it's hard to imagine a time when they weren't part of the fabric of a sport. The innovations Coppett was bemoaning, for example, included shoulder pads and helmets for American football players, artificial turf, and dimpled golf balls. Likewise, pearls were clutched, and the honour of many was called into question, when Prince introduced a new racket with a head over 50% larger than the competitors, offering a far bigger surface area with which to hit the ball. "Secret weapon or barn door," read the 1976 New York Times Magazine headline. Wooden tennis rackets of the kind used by Bjorn Borg were used at Wimbledon up until 1987. Today's rackets can be up to 25% lighter. Precise weight at elite levels depends on player preference, and are usually made of fiberglass, carbon fiber, or graphite. Few today would call for a return to smaller, heavier rackets with elusive sweet spots, and their return would make for an almost unrecognizably slower game. But there is still robust debate about the precise ratio of wool to synthetic fiber that the felt covering tennis balls should contain, since each company adheres to a different standard, and the fuzziness of a ball helps determine its speed. Running trainers too have had material highs and lows. When Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile on the 6th of May 1954, he wore black running spikes of very thin leather, jazzed up with white contrast stitching and sturdy cotton laces, made for him by a firm called G.T. Law & Son. "I could see there was an advantage in having the shoe as light as possible," he said. His weighed a feathery 127.6 grams. In the decades since, Adidas and Nike have become the ones to beat when it comes to high-profile running shoes. Leather is eschewed in favor of fabric, more breathable and better in rain. Although the mile distance has largely been eclipsed by the 1500 meters, the current record holder for the former distance is Hicham El-Jerouj, a wiry, friendly-faced Moroccan runner. His time, a record held since 1999, is 3:43:13. Nike, who also sponsored him, enlisted El-Jerouj to help them build a track shoe in 2004 to commemorate the Bannister 4-minute mile. Their Zoom Miler spike, which weighed the same as Bannister's, was made of very different materials, including polyether polymers and ethylene vinyl acetate foam cushioning. Just before the 2012 Olympics, Nike launched another shoe they hoped would please elite runners and paying customers. The former told Nike's designers that they didn't want a shoe that felt like a shoe. What they wanted was one that felt more like a sock. The Flyknit racer and trainer were the result, and the ancestor of the latest generation, the Zoom Vaporfly. This debuted at the Nike-sponsored attempt to break the two-hour marathon, called Breaking 2, in May 2017, worn by athletes including Eliud Kipchoge, a Kenyan long-distance runner. The Flyknit uppers were made from synthetic yarns. Since 2016, these have used polyester gleaned from recycled plastic bottles, continuously knitted to give structure and durability over long distances with as few seams as possible. The upper fits snugly to the foot because of the knitted fabric's inherent stretch and is breathable enough to be worn without socks. Although plenty of gushing articles and press releases will assure you the Flyknit also revolutionized athletic footwear in terms of weight, the racer is 40 grams heavier than Bannister's 1954 leather pair. Flyknit and its offspring have proved so popular with runners and so potent a marketing tool after their prominence at the Olympics that the fabric has since been rolled out across product lines, from Converse Chuck Taylors to sports bras. Although the Zoom Vaporfly Elites were an exclusive concept car version only given to Kipchoge and other Nike-sponsored runners, a mass-market version, the Zoom Vaporfly 4%, have proven to be commercial gold. They're expensive, $250, but the promise of increased efficiency on race day has proved lure enough for many. Kipchoge, for what it's worth, although he loves running in them, is nevertheless conflicted. When asked about the cleanest possible marathon time by a writer for Wired, he revealed himself to be, at heart, a purist. "You ask me clean? No technology, no help? That is what Abebe Bikila ran in 1960. That was barefoot. The cleanest." Market forces. Obviously, we love it when people can push innovation a little bit more. Kate Wilton, Senior Director of Merchandising and Design, Speedo, 2016. Sports and the clothes that go with them have long been commercial enterprises. The North American sports market, worth $60.5 billion in 2014, was predicted to reach $73.5 billion by 2019. Companies in the industry, Nike, Adidas, the NBA, to name just a few, although harried by drooping live sports viewer figures and unpredictable global sales, have benefited from vastly increased demand for sports and athleisure clothing. The market for the latter alone, by some estimates, reached $97 billion in 2016. Increased appetite has led to increased competition. For the traditional players, this has meant attempts to reclaim the space. In part, this is about differentiating their products through technology. In 2015, for example, Reebok began offering clothing laced with Kevlar, the ultra-strong material used in bulletproof vests, and Under Armour and Lululemon offer socks, tops, and tights with anti-odor properties. But given that one pair of leggings is very much like another, companies also rely on sponsorship deals with high-profile athletes and visibility at well-attended, newsworthy events to curry favor with consumers. Like the Zoom Vaporflies and the Speedo LZR Racers, many of the innovations showcased on professional athletes are later offered to the mass market. In both instances, the athletes leading out the latest sportswear tech for their sponsors were rumored to have been offered bonuses of $1 million if they made history. Products worn during medal-winning attempts and endorsed by sporting heroes are endowed with cachet. The money earned from stronger sales goes into the production of innovations designed to give pro athletes an edge over their rivals. This cycle is either virtuous or corrupting, depending on your point of view. A great deal of the performance of professional athletes in a race, event, or match is determined well beforehand and within the confines of their own skulls. Rebecca Adlington trained in regular swimming costumes, reserving the LZR for race day itself. This was in part because her race day suits were two or three sizes too small. "You want it super tight," she says. "It needs to be like a second skin. You couldn't wait to get it off." But there was also a mental component. The feel of the race suit, which was so tight and smooth and paper thin that she could almost feel the air bubbles against her skin as she dove into the pool, was something special. It's the same as why you shave for race days, although it barely makes any difference. A lot of it is mental. End of the lane. Serious sport has nothing to do with fair play. It is bound up with hatred, jealousy, boastfulness, disregard of all rules, and sadistic pleasure in witnessing violence. In other words, it is war minus the shooting. George Orwell, The Sporting Spirit, Tribune, 1945. Sports are not fair. Some teams have better access to equipment, nutrition, or other resources. Some, by their very nature, are impossible to get proficient in unless you have a great deal of time and money. Some people are born with longer limbs, smaller breasts, better economy of movement, a greater capacity for endurance, or with parents who have the wherewithal to recognize and nurture their talents. Some are men, and therefore more likely to be given better public exposure and sponsorship deals. And yet, it is the idea of fairness and purity that lies at the heart of why some technologies cause sporting upset. In an article for the Sunday Times of South Africa, the influential sports writer Ross Tucker argued that performance-enhancing shoes should be banned, so that we can appreciate running for what it is, and not for the unmeasurable aspects provided by technology. Yet all shoes are, to an extent, performance-enhancing, especially when it comes to marathons run through cities on tarmac and concrete. The line between acceptable and performance-enhancing is continuously being tussled over and renegotiated by fans, participators, and brands offering new equipment and technology. For those not interested or invested in sports, this process can be disorientating. Some seemingly small advances can provoke uproar, while others go unnoticed. This is the conundrum being faced by brands looking to update kit and equipment. In order to appeal to the mass market, they have to differentiate their products by showing consumers that, by wearing and using them, the average person can be faster, stronger, and more likely to win. If, however, their success is too overt, the advantage gained by their sponsored athletes too great, moral outrage ensues. Sports themselves also have an incentive to keep things interesting by helping athletes get ever harder, better, faster, stronger. Marcus Rogan, an Austrian backstroke specialist, was in favour of the polyurethane suit because they made swimmers faster. "We're the most popular boring sport in the world," he said, "and so we only survive on records." After all, very few would argue that swimmers should go back to baggy woolen suits, or suggest that female swimmers should wear costumes with extraneous modesty panels, as they did in the early 20th century. In total, 147 swimming world records were forged in 2009 by swimmers wearing polyurethane suits, 43 of these during the FINA World Championships in Rome. The controversy generated by the suits transcended the swimming world to become part of a wider, ongoing conversation over the role of technology, brands, and sponsorship in sport. One of the biggest fears was that the record set would prove unbreakable unless another round of technological improvements was allowed. Polyurethane suits, it was argued, were the thin end of a wedge that would, in time, rob swimming of its integrity, much as doping had done decades previously. These fears, at least, have largely proved to be unfounded. 6 world records were broken in the first 4 days of the Olympic Games in Rio. As of the 1st of January 2018, only 13 records set during the tech suit era remain. The reasons why these records have fallen with relative ease are complex. Sports science has evolved, leading to greater understanding of nutrition, efficiency, and the ways in which technique can be adapted for individual swimmers. Pools themselves are being adjusted and redesigned to make them better environments in which to compete. They are being made deeper and wider, reducing the turbulence and waves splashing back over swimmers' bodies and slowing them down. They are kept between 25 degrees and 28 degrees Celsius, temperatures deemed to be optimum for racing muscles. Research has been done into lane dividers and the drainage at the sides of the pool too, ensuring water doesn't ricochet around and slow people down. But many in the industry believe that just as the problems of 2008 and 2009 lay in the fabric of the suits, that is where the solutions were found too. The generation of suits that followed the FINA regulations were explicitly designed to claw back some of the speed that the designers knew they would be losing with the ban on polyurethane and other non-textiles. Some new suits contain an almost skeletal structure of bonding and seaming to help remind swimmers of and hold them in the best position for racing. Arena have added carbon fibre to their nylon-woven suits. The carbon, configured either in a grid-like structure or in horizontal bands through the fabric, depending on the suit, increases the durability of the suits and helps add compression. Speedo never created a fully polyurethane suit in 2009, instead focusing on making one that would be in pole position once the ban came into force. They looked at how racing yachts and Formula One cars dealt with resistance and drag, and applied some of the same thinking to the new Fastskin 3 and Fastskin LZR Racer X suits. The latter were released for the Rio Olympics. These used zoned compression. The fabric contained more lycra and therefore more stretch in some areas than others, to compress the body up to 3 times more than the LZR. The idea was to create as stiff a skin as possible over the surface of the body, moulding it into a more efficient tubular shape and simultaneously preventing the skin from moving around too much. All this, Speedo claimed, meant that the resistance produced by a swimmer's body was reduced by around 17% and oxygen economy increased by 11%. The only problem, at least for female athletes, was how to get into the suits. Lacking zips, entry is through an armhole. Some have reported needing a full hour to get one on. With a bit of practice, they have been assured, it will only take 10 to 15 minutes. One of the things the tech suits made clear to trainers and athletes is the importance of body positioning. Coaches learned a lot about what that perfect positioning looked like and have worked since the ban on recouping the suit's benefits by working on core stability, for example, and ensuring positioning has more prominence in drills. Some coaches even bought up stocks of the banned suits and have been using them as a training aid, so that their swimmers could get a feel for how the body moves in them and for how fast it is possible to be when compressed and taut. That era, according to Stu Isaac, raised the bar. The suits, in other words, are still breaking records.